Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the case against Medicare for All. And Richard, virtually all of the Democratic candidates for president are endorsing some kind of expansion of the federal government's role in healthcare. Among the more left-leaning ones, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, the push is, amongst all of them, for some variation on Medicare for All, essentially a single-payer system in which the federal government would provide for Americans' healthcare needs. Now, there are a lot of angles that we could explore here, but I want to start you with the fiscal one, because it's been widely noted by critics on the right that this would require pretty significant tax increases, and tax increases on the middle class, not just on the wealthy, if you were really trying to finance this. And the response that you will hear from people like Bernie Sanders is, well, it's not really a cost. You're just changing the incidence. So, yes, your taxes may go up, but you're not going to be paying premiums or co-pays or deductibles anymore. And anyway, he would argue, Medicare is cheaper than privately provided health care. So you're going to come out ahead on net. How do you react to that?
I regard that as a fantasy of the highest order. Let's start with the first situation. He doesn't just want to shift the incidence from private to public with respect to this program. He also wants to expand the various kinds of programs. Medicare is a very complicated system in terms of the way in which it operates on a day-to-day basis. And there are many things that you could get on Medicare, which you get at a level one. And if you want to get level two, you have to pay something additional to the party who is providing it. You also have the copays and the deductibles, and the purpose of those things is to sort of try to limit the amount of care you're going to get because of the constant fear that if people are going to be told that you could get all the medical care you want for zero, the only cost you're paying is that of personal inconvenience, they're basically going to consume relatively low-value services at extremely high costs of provision, and that gap becomes a systematic deficit. And the critique doesn't take into account the change in the program. Secondly, I mean, it's also very important to understand that when you do run a program like that through the private system, the insurance companies are actually providing a service for the premium they get, and that service may well be lost. So if you're a large insurer and you have a big book of business and you have fairly accurate accounts as to how programs succeed and fail, what you can do is you can make intelligent recommendations to doctors and to healthcare groups in ways that will essentially steer you towards optimum treatment. And a lot of this stuff is in the form of trade secrets that companies don't voluntarily share with others. But if every company has one of these programs, and virtually all of them do, what it does in effect is it sort of helps to keep your costs down. It's not at all clear when you put this into the hands of the federal government whether it's going to be a paymaster on the one hand only or whether it's going to take these particular other tasks on in order to describe them. And so when you put it into this particular situation, therefore, what you're going to do is you're going to see a much higher cost. Sanders people and Elizabeth Warren and Marcia Angel, who used to work for the New England Journal of Medicine, they just treat it as a one-to-one substitution, ignoring the incentive effects of this situation. Everybody who's done an independent study on this sort of puts the total that you're dealing with at somewhere between $25 trillion over the next 10 years and $40 trillion. And the $40 trillion figures, you know, about 12% of GDP to run just this particular system, assuming that you could run it as well. The other thing I think that becomes very clear is it's not at all clear that anybody wants this particular kind of service. People on Medicare love the program because essentially they get choice of physicians and they also get a subsidy equal to probably about 75% of what they pay in any individual case with very little marginal cost that they face. So they like it. Everybody else has to pick up the bill. But most people in private health care plans don't want to move. And if you one thing that I think to mention is you actually look at the magnitude of the shift, it turns out close to half the population is still an employer-based plan, because the Obama program that was supposed to transform those things was never put into effect. So it's only the individual mandate piece that has been done, and that covers about billion, 8 million people or so, which is a tiny fraction of 155 million or so who are in the other kinds of plan. So you're going to have to run this massive shift. And if you think you could run a transition like this at a very low cost against fierce resistance, you're just mistaken. And so it's not only the question of whether or not you can do one thing in steady state or the other thing in a steady state. You have to figure out how to get from here to there. And you're going to have to transform everything. There are all sorts of complicated healthcare programs of one kind or another, very complicated physician payment arrangements and so forth. It's not at all clear that Medicaid is going to try to control physician salary. But on the other hand, if they don't, then the thing will just simply absolutely run out of control. And so I think you could say with a great deal of confidence that this is a fiscal nightmare in the making.
You wrote about this topic in your piece for Defining Ideas this week, and in there, as you defend the idea of delivering healthcare through private markets, you say, I'm quoting you here, the central function of any price system is to allocate scarce resources to people who need and desire them the most, close quote. But if Elizabeth Warren were listening to that, she might say that you left out one factor, which is those scarce resources are also allocated to the people who can most afford it. And healthcare is a human right, so it's immoral to make the ability to pay the criterion by which one accesses the system. What would your response to that
be? Well, the answer is I didn't say it was the only system. I said that's one of the ways in which voluntary markets work. And so the question is, when you do have people with some ability to pay, is it better to try to do this through fees for specific services that they can choose, or whether it's better to do it through a system of taxation on these same people, where in fact they have no control over what they're going to get? And there's no question for people who do have the ability to pay, the system is vastly superior to the other. Well, then there's the question of what do we do with people who don't have the ability to pay? This is not a new problem. The 19th century solution to this is regarded as almost laughable and antiquated, but essentially it was the rise of charitable institutions funded by people who had a very keen appreciation of the fact that a two-year-old toddler cares a lot about its life, but it simply doesn't have the ability to pay if left at a foundling home. And so what you do is you see huge amounts of charitable activities. I can still remember when my father back in the 1950s had this futile dream of my becoming a doctor. He sat me down in his study one day and told me about the ethics of billing. And it included a huge amount of services that the private market gives to people who cannot afford to pay, simply as part of your professional obligations as a physician. And that's exactly the way in which he ran his life. Those payments were, or those performances were very, very extensive. The moment it turned out you got a guaranteed payment system starting in the mid-1960s, all of that particular element started to disappear. So I think the Elizabeth Warren situation sort of associates a market with only exchange transactions. A more accurate account of a market is one that takes into account, in addition to the exchange transactions, a lot of the voluntary and charitable transactions. And these were done in enormous numbers in the age before the mandatory payments were there. So then what you want to do is to say, well, how many people are left out of the system in those days and how many are left out today? And, you know, you don't get a very convincing story to say that more people are covered now than were covered then. If you go back and look at the early 19th century and early 20th century, the early 20th century and late 19th century figure, there are very few people who sort of left out on the street to die. People understood exactly what was going on, and the numbers were very small. And so I think if you're going to sort of take the healthcare stuff, it would be fair to say that everybody who was in this business then understood the limits of the ability to pay system, and it's very unfair of modern critics like, you know, Elizabeth Warren to ignore that feature and to assume that whenever you had large numbers of poor people in those days, they were left out to the street to die. It just never happened in that particular fashion. So, as again, it's two parts. Where there is an ability to pay, taxes are vastly less efficient than selecting your own plan with its own benefits. And where it turns out that you have people who can't afford to pay, charitable institutions tend to be much more efficient at giving out the care than do public institutions. So I think she's wrong both ways.
Some of the more moderate Democrats in this field have stopped short of calling for Medicare for all and have instead revived a term that we last heard in wide circulation during the Obamacare debates, which is the public option. Explain for us how that differs from Medicare for All and whether it's fair to characterize it as the moderate position.
Well, a lot of it depends on what the terms of the options are. But essentially what happens is it says to somebody, you are allowed to remain in the current plan that you have, paying the fees that you have, if it turns out that you want to. But it turns out that the state is going to provide an additional option. And if you prefer that option to the ones that the private plans are given, then by all means you could go. Competition turns out to be fair. The difficulty with this is every time you start putting in a public option, you start throwing in a public subsidy. And so essentially you have one firm that has to pay taxes and another firm that starts to receive tax revenues to offer its services at a lower price. And in the short run, what's going to happen is people are going to migrate from the more expensive to the less expensive system. And then after a while, it turns out you won't have very much private coverage. And if you don't have very much private coverage, you're not going to be able to transfer wealth from those plans into the other plan. It's all going to have to come out of general revenues. So the strongest objection is, unless you have enormous discipline over the way that public plan starts to run, in the end, the subsidies will drive the private plans out. So it's just a matter of timing. It's not a matter of whether you're going to shift at all. And, you know, to give you another illustration, there were many very effective developing private plans for the delivery of electrical services in the Tennessee Valley before they put the TVA up. And sure enough, once the TVA was up, all the private plans started to disappear because they could not compete with it. And so I think it's a little bit disingenuous to start talking about this as a public option unless you specify whether it's a subsidized or an unsubsidized operation.
A lot of the moderate Democrats and almost the entire universe of Republicans have made the point that you did earlier, that one of the real liabilities of a single-payer system is how many people would be ripped away from their private plans, which many people like. And that at times gets conflated with a defense of sort of the healthcare status quo writ large. It's worth noting, you mentioned this earlier, most people don't necessarily shop for health insurance the way that they might, say, for car insurance. The Census Bureau numbers from 2017 is that more than half, 56% of Americans got their health insurance through their employer. Now, so that may be better than Medicare for All, but is that an ideal arrangement for American healthcare?
It has the following serious difficulty. It provides a kind of an implicit subsidy because the premiums in question are going to be deductible to the firm, but the benefits are not going to be taxable to the individuals who receive them at any particular point in time. And many people, myself included, have thought that if you really want to run this system correctly, you want to get the embedded subsidy out of there. That has proved to be absolutely impossible in the current state of the world. And so people says what you ought to do then is to take ordinary individuals who are not part of any health plan and let them deduct their premiums to be on a par. The problem with individual care is there's too much adverse selection and too much strategic behavior by the insureds, whereas if you're with an employer group, they have the benefit of the law. The insurance company has the benefit of the law of large numbers. So the individual market is always going to be unstable. And going through an employer is a perfectly sensible way to try to do that. But you could also run it through church groups and other kinds of voluntary associations, friendly societies and the like, and get many of those particular advantages. And I think all of these options, in effect, ought to be explored. One of the things that several of my friends who are evangelicals will do is they actually get their health care plans through churches. And this, again, gives you individual tailoring. These people are not really keen on getting money for abortions and for other kinds of activities that may be put into a public plan because it's inconsistent with their religious belief. If you have a greater homogeneity within the group, you have a small risk of cross subsidies, and you have an ability to really focus on the care that everybody wants, you put people into this large plan. Remember, it's a state monopolist. There's no other place to go. You don't like what's going on there. Either you beat them up and perhaps get some concession, or in fact, you have to suffer. And none of the defenders of the single health care plan would ever defend a situation in which a private firm had an entire monopoly over the provision of health care services, so you merged Aetna and Humana and every other company into one. Everyone would say it's an antitrust violation. Well, now you've got an unresponsive nonprofit making institution that's going to be in that same monopoly position. And Lord help us if those people are put in charge. For amongst other things, there will be no innovation coming out of that particular system, either in the way in which you provide services, no innovation with respect to capital improvements and things like that. And so what you're going to do is you're going to basically have the people who run the VA and the people who run the post office running this system. I think it's just an absolute crying shame that all of the people who are so obviously opposed to private health care insurance never once start to actually investigate the way in which they work and the kinds of benefits that they provide. It is always done on the assumption that we know better. This started with, you know, Barack Obama back in the years about 2012 and so forth, where when he threw all the people off of their private plan, he announced very blandly, well, all these were crappy plans, as if he'd read them, knew what they were about, knew where the people wanted it to. And so there is just an incredible amount of intellectual arrogance and egotism on the part of those people who think that they know so much for the American people that they can tell everybody else that they're misguided in their health care plan. I can assure you, I would bitterly resent anything that I managed to obtain under the current system being taken over by a group of individuals who don't care about my welfare, don't mind my preferences, and in fact, the by and large economic illiterates and everything that they turn out to do. I mean, I don't think Bernie Sanders knows what a supply curve looks like or a demand curve looks like. I mean, this is a guy who's simply doing it on intellectual fumes without the most elementary understanding of the way in which healthcare shares and the way in which healthcare differs from standard economic models.
So final question. I'll play that forward. Let's assume a political deluge. It's 2021. Bernie Sanders has just been sworn in as our 46th president. Democrats control the Congress, and their first act is to steamroll through Medicare for All. In a world where this actually happens, what does the American healthcare system end up looking like as a consequence? And what does the American economy end up looking like?
Well, first of all, it's going to be a huge drain on the economy. Right now, you know, healthcare stocks are a very large and powerful portion of the various indexes. If you were to wipe these things out and not to compensate them, and there'd be no way that you could compensate them, what you would do is you would see several, you know, trillions of dollars just simply disappear from the market base. And if that money disappears, there's going to be fewer things by way of jobs, by way of dividends, and so forth, because they don't plan to give any kind of compensation for it. So the first thing you're going to have is they'll whip it through, and there'll be an immediate injunction that will be put on the system by one of the companies saying, you're wiping me out, you're not giving me any compensation, we have to hear this. So you're going to get at least several years of limbo in which you're not quite sure what's going to happen. Assuming that the whole thing does start to go through, what's going to happen is there's going to be a massive form of panic. Because what you're going to do is not only get rid of the large health care plans. I mean, just to give you a simple illustration, my wife and I are members of a group called One Medical. And no matter where you are in the country, if you get sick, you could call them up and go into their branch and get pretty decent services. There are many, many people, including myself from time to time, use walk-in clinics in New York City. All of these are devices in which a cash payment system is used instead of an insurance system. And getting rid of the third party, of course, gets rid of the overconsumption risk and the moral hazard risk and a lot of other things. Are you putting all of these people out of business as well? And then if you're not, who's going to staff them and how are they going to be run? Businesses have a real economy of scale. There's absolutely no one who thinks that you could run a management, and God knows who would do this, which would be able to handle, you know, $4 or $5 trillion worth of business with a series of executives who probably never run anything larger than a five and dime store. So this will be an absolute catastrophe. Socialism has failed everywhere it's been tried. And with, you know, Bernie Sanders is a socialist and Elizabeth Warren just dances around it announcing that she's a capitalist to the bone while supporting the most bizarre reforms for capitalism ever. But essentially what you will do is you will see a decline. This has nothing to do, for example, with the Canadian system, where they do have lots of physician choices, but they have very, very strict budgetary control on the processes. Every one of the states has to live within its budgets. The American system is going to be the other way. You spend it, we'll have to find a way to fund it. And when you throw this in, together with such modest programs as universal college education, the Green New Deal, free housing for who, it will be essentially a country that will be unrecognizable in the world. I don't believe that it can happen. But these people, as far as I can tell, have no awareness of the fact that incentives matter, scarcity matters, self-interest matters. They are trying to put together a society which will certainly not work in heaven, but it may well bring us to hell.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.